Hey, Denver, it's time for this bi-weekly meeting of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee of Denver City Council. Join us for the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee starting now.
Good afternoon. My name is Chantel M. Lewis, and I represent District 8. Welcome to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. Today is Wednesday, September 17th, already, 2025, and I am excited to chair this committee. With that, we'll do a round of introductions and start with you, Pro Tem.
Hello there. Good afternoon. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Good afternoon. Flora Lidres, Lucky District 7.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Hey, Denver. Chris Hines, Denver's Perfect 10.
Great. And we have no virtual participation. We do have an action item, a number of action items from the Denver International Airport, and I'll have you all do an introduction and then you can jump in.
Phil Washington, CEO of Denver International Airport.
George Karyanakis, Interim Chief Commercial Officer.
Kevin Forgett, State and Local Legislative Advisor.
And Pamela Deschant, Senior Vice President of Concessions at DEN.
Welcome.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you for your time, everyone. Good afternoon. We are here before you today with a very distinct and unique group of concessions contracts that we will be asking to be amended. I'd like to provide you some context before we get into the details of the contracts up for amendment. Over the past few years at DEN, we've been really working hard to modernize the program, to bring in new concessionaires, more small, local businesses. So a huge modernization program going on. The one thing that we had not modernized in our program had been the length of the contract terms. The terms went back to the very first day of the airport, 7 years for retail, 10 years for food and beverage. So as we redeveloped the program, we realized recently that, you know what, in order to keep up with today's world and today's costs, we needed to right-size the contract term lengths, which is why in January of 2024, it was January 1st, 2024, all new contracts moving forward have new contract term lengths, which are 9 years for retail and 12 years for all food and beverage. This is really important because the cost of building out at the airport, we learned, has doubled for food and beverage operators and has tripled for retailers. So it made sense to us that effective January 1st of last year, moving forward, we would lengthen those terms. Our partners were grateful. We did, however, have a group of concessionaires that came to us and said, thank you for the changes. This makes a lot more sense to us. We'll be able to recover all of the capital costs that we put in. But I just missed that deadline, right? And so we listened, we looked at the numbers, we heard all of the feedback. And what we did is we went back to the drawing board and looked at our entire concessions portfolio. And of all the concessions contracts, we grouped them into three separate buckets. And today we're going to talk about the second group. These are people who came to us and said, we're stuck in this middle earth, as coined by Mr. Washington. We're stuck in this middle earth. So although you've extended the terms, we can't get that benefit. It's just beyond our reach, just based on a hard line in the sand, a date. Furthermore, these concessionaires said to us, we were not able to enjoy the privilege of being at the airport some since 1995. Fast forward to today, we have that special Middle Earth group before you. There are a total of 28 contracts that we would like to right size by adding term. And of those 28, we have a group of 14 before you today with the intention of coming back to ask for the remaining 14 to be amended. The chart before you shows a listing of the joint venture partnerships that are included in this group two requested action. And again, the remaining 14 not shown here, but on a subsequent slide will come later. This is just a recap of the groupings I spoke to you about. Groups one, two, and three. Group one we call old school, right? Some have been at the airport since the beginning, which we love, right? They've been part of all of the growth and the great experience we've had until now. However, a lot of term has been enjoyed by these concessionaires. Middle Earth, these are the ones awarded in 2019 and before January of 2024, and then the newbies, right? All the new contracts moving forward, Group 3. We provided a little more detail on the different groupings. Although we're not asking for action today on Group 1, here is some additional context and further details should you be interested. These are our focus today. Again, lacking the legacy benefits of Group 1 and the modernization of Group 3. We can keep going. Keep going. So in alignment with Vision 100, right, we believe that right-sizing Group 2 would create that equity that we stand behind in the concessions department in Denver, at Denver. More details on the joint ventures that are before you today here. We have a lot of details about this, huh? And a repeat of the list of 14 contracts, asking for your approval if you want to. This chart here highlights the 14 before you today, and the ones that remain in white in the table would be the next tranche to bring. That's our overview and our request. Can I answer any questions?
Thank you so much for the previous briefing. I have no questions at this time.
Thank you.
Any folks have any questions?
Sure.
I do have a question. Thank you. And I do think it's great. The slide presentation is really called Middle Earth. thank you. It just made me chuckle. One of the questions that I do have is, these are coming through now. When's the next tranche do you expect to come through? Is it just processing, or what is the?
It is. It's just processing. These are the ones that we had complete in a packet ready to bring before you. There are several reasons, right, that the other 14 didn't get left behind but didn't make it into this batch. We have concessionaires that are going through personal issues, medical issues, and that's about it. Yeah.
30, 60 days.
Yeah, the next time we can get scheduled.
The next few months, we'll bring the next group.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And then would any of these concessionaires in this current tranche or in the next one be concessionaires that'll go into the Great Hall area as well? Or are those, is that a different?
Well, it's yet to be seen who bids. It very well could be, but the RFPs are out on the street right now for the Great Hall. So we won't know if some of them will be the same until we get the bids and go through the selection process. Maybe.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have any other questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Councilman Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the airport. I think I know the answer to this. When you're considering minority and women-owned business enterprises, disability is not a consideration. Is that correct?
As far as
a minority qualification?
You know, I would, for a formal answer, I'd have to ask the DSBO office who assigns those goals.
Okay.
So if we can follow up with you, I'd be happy to.
And I did recently ask them, and they said no. My thought was, in general, the reason I've been on council 6 years, I've worked obviously with the airport quite a bit over those 6 years. Thought out of ignorance was that there was no certification system for disability owned businesses. I have recently learned that there is one, that the federal government recognizes disability in. On their website, they also, I just found this out last week. Also on their website, they say that the state of Colorado also uses disability in. So I just thought that was an interesting comment. Obviously, it is such a niche that we don't even consider people with disabilities, and 51% or greater owned businesses that are owned by people with disabilities. You already have a vendor a concessionaire that has multiple locations at the airport that qualifies for MWB under other category, but he would also qualify under the disability status. So it just started making me think, well, wait a minute, I wonder if there are folks that do qualify as disability is also a civil rights protected class. And so it just made me wonder if perhaps the airport had a category or a recognition process that isn't DISPO. But if you use DISPO, then I already know the answer.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah, we'll take a look at that. We have actually, probably about a year and a half ago or so, changed or added to one of our guiding principles, accessibility. So EDIA, or equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility. We've added that at the airport as one of our guiding principles. So we will look at that. We will talk to DISPO. I am aware of the disability category at the federal government. As a matter of fact, the veteran disability is a huge thing. And as a disabled veteran myself, I know about that pretty well. So we'll take a look at that.
Yeah, in there. Yeah, so I think they have three certification categories. One is disability. Mm-hmm. One is a veteran who happens to have a disability, or company 51% or greater owned by a veteran who has a disability. And then a third category, someone who's a veteran who has a service connected disability.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And by recognizing disability, and we'd also be. Mm-hmm. Recognizing another principle that I know we have at the city, and that's giving preference to those who served our country to give us the way of life that we have here in America. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. And I would add in our discussions yesterday that one of the, in addition to the extension of the 2 years, I know part of the work of bringing these tranches to us was to have some ADA alignment, if I recall correctly from our conversation yesterday. So I think that's an important piece for you to know as well, Councilman Hines. And then I wanted to, Pam, if you are up to it, to talk about the ABDBE and the SBEC, because it was very valuable to me the way in which you provided that insight, and I think it would be helpful for folks as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can we please go back to the slide with the first one of the first lists? This one.
Yes.
Okay. So what you'll see here under the company name, it's the name of the joint venture, but the important part that we're talking about is the status. And it's either ACDBE, Airport Concessions Certified, Airport Concessions Disadvantaged Business Enterprise. All of our contracts at the airport require ACDBE goals and participation. So we have several concessionaires who are 100% ACDBE, and then the rest make up of these joint ventures. Listed in the established goal, you'll see the percentage. Now, those are going to vary. You'll see different 36%, 30%, and those are based on the equity studies that the airport does every 3 years to help us determine what the appropriate goals are. The other acronym listed, SBEC, Small Business Enterprise Concession. This is a program that is new to Dunn since 2019, and it is a certification that small businesses can get in addition to ACDBE if they choose. The important distinction is that this is race and gender neutral. It is strictly based on size. And several of the contracts before you are 100% SBEC, meaning these are small businesses, and they are 100% owner of these concessions, which makes us super proud. This program has become a regular part of concessions. We launched it in 2019 as a pilot just to see if it would work. It's been so successful that it's become part of who we are and what we'll continue to do. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for taking the opportunity to highlight that, because I did think it was valuable, and it's valuable for this committee to know as well. I don't have any further questions. There aren't other folks in the queue. And so if no one has any further questions, I'd ask for a motion to move this forward.
Move.
Thank you. First and the second, Alvidres and Hines. Do we need a roll call vote? I sure hope not. Great. Did you have any announcements that you wanted to make before?
Yes, okay. Very briefly. Thank you, Chair Lewis and committee members. Just a couple items in terms of updates. Last week, Den, along with the Denver Fire Department and Dottie, celebrated the groundbreaking of a new fire station. The new station will address the growth around the airport and serving various neighborhoods like the Gateway neighborhood, Montbello, Green Valley Ranch. Council member Watson was there. Also, Council member Gilmore was there, and she spoke at the event. And so it was a great event. It was a great day as well. I'm also excited to share that earlier this week, and this was mentioned a little bit earlier about the Great Hall, we are nearing completion of the Great Hall, as you all know. So earlier this week, Monday, we announced 6 dining and retail opportunities or requests for proposals for the Great Hall, intended to transform the Great Hall. And those opportunities are going to be located on level 5 when you come up from the A-line right into the terminal. We are, of course, finalizing that build out. Our aim is to attract local brands, national brands, regional brands, and I think there's going to be great interest in that. The 6 RFPs included a grab-and-go cafe. That is a 100% SBEC opportunity. We just talked about that. Fast casual restaurant, a casual dining with a bar, food hall, travel convenience marketplace, which is another 100% AC or SBEC opportunity as well. And so we're very excited about releasing those. Right now, we will bring in, or proposals will be submitted. We'll evaluate those and decide who goes in. And that is my update.
Beautiful. I think we have a few questions, Councilman Flynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Grab and go in the South Mod 3, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's pre-TSA.
Correct.
And I could see that'd be a little problematic if somebody picks up a drink or a water bottle that you can't take through security.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is essential to have there, maybe this is there also, is a sit-down place where people waiting for arriving passengers can have lunch or dinner, mm-hmm. breakfast while they're waiting. Mm-hmm. For their parties to arrive. That's something that's mm-hmm. really been missing since yeah. the Great Hall renovation started.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great out at Stapleton, also the old yeah. Sky Chefs
yeah.
restaurant, you know, where you look out on the concourse.
Right.
But, you know, people who arrive early and have time to kill and are hungry,
mm-hmm.
Or their party arrives after a long flight and are hungry, just a nice sit-down place in the unsecured area. Is that part of the
Absolutely.
RFP?
That is one of the RFPs. That's one of the RFPs that we have put out, a sit-down casual dining place with a bar. So that is one of them. The grab-and-go piece, you know, people waiting and things like that, but also our employees, too, that may want to get a grab-and-go, go out to the plaza and things like that. So I think the clientele for both the sit-down and the grab-and-go will be pretty substantial.
Thank you. My impression has always been that grab-and-go is always better post-security
yeah.
because that's where Harry and I might grab a bottle of water mm-hmm. to take on the plane that we couldn't bring through.
So, right. That's true.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. That's all.
Great, thank you. Would you all mind sending the information for the RFP so that I might include it in my newsletters in case
sure.
folks might be interested?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
I did have one just follow-up question.
You
it's
got
okay.
me twice.
It's
I'm
okay.
so sorry.
No, I just wanted to touch on something else totally unrelated to this, which is the recent news around parking and the parking issues.
Mm-hmm.
There, I think there's some confusion. I know I hadn't contacted you when I went into a lot and there was no parking and I exited and paid. Like, what is that the normal thing? And do you have any answers to, like, the $1,000 parking charges that people have, that's been seen in the news? So if we could just speak to that.
Yeah, that was a glitch from the contractor that manages parking. We have since resolved that. It was a glitch, and It was unfortunate. I hated to see that happen, but we have resolved that.
Okay. And then on the other issue, if someone drives into the parking lot, there's no parking and parks out, and comes out late, do they still get charged for parking?
I need to look into that one. Okay. Yeah, we'll take a look into that one.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thanks for raising that. Mm-hmm. We're all like, what?
I'll send you the news article later.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you.
We're well familiar.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you,
it.
Kylie. See you later. Appreciate you.
All right.
Take off. Good luck.
Yeah. All right. Well, these folks are headed out. We can get Kazers set up to talk to us about things.
Thank
Hello.
You.
Thank you. Good to see y'all. Thank you. Thank you.
Join us. Crack the deck if you want to. Whatever.
Great. So this is a briefing from CASR regarding the office energy projects. And so if you all could introduce yourselves and then you can jump into your presentation.
Hi, everyone. Good to see you again. Jonathan Rogers, call me Johnny. I'm the acting deputy director in Denver's Office of Climate Action. Joined today with two of our leaders on our energy projects team.
I'm Drew Halpern, senior energy project manager, Climate Action Division in CASR.
Kimber Priest, senior energy project manager.
Kimber? K-I-M-B-E-R?
Yes.
Okay,
thank you for asking.
Mm-hmm. We're excited to be back and talking with you about another aspect of our work. Always appreciate your feedback, your interest in how we are deploying taxpayer dollars into the community, and really, in this case, focused on how we lead by example through our municipal facilities and operations. Quick overview, reminder of the CASR vision. You know, together we build a carbon pollution free, sustainable, and climate resilient Denver for all. Really emphasizing how do we as quickly and equitably as possible reduce our carbon emissions and maximize our investment in the community, really supporting climate vulnerable community members through our work. As we talked about last time, we've got a long way to go to get to zero emissions and are really looking at all of the myriad strategies that we need to influence policy, really shift the status quo in terms of what we're doing as a community that can really bend this curve to get us closer to zero. And a big part of that is leading by example. You know, we want to show what's possible. We want to walk the walk through our work. You know, Denver's city facilities and operations, we have a carbon footprint as well. It is going to be more successful for us to inspire others in the community if we are doing that work as well. And, you know, no one's going to let us recommend changes to building code or other policy work if we haven't shown that these things are possible and practical and really, you know, cost-effective and enabling of other benefits. So at this point, I will kick it over to Drew and Kimber to really talk through some of that work and welcome your questions, your feedback, your interest in what we do and how we continue to do it.
Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Chair, Councilpeople, for having us. We really appreciate, as Johnny said, the support over time, inquiry into the work we're doing. We think the ask is quite broad to make a large wholesale change in complex and complicated systems. But we think we have a view towards the future and a good idea of what we need to do to see those change come to fruition.
Excellent. I'd say as well, there's not an explicit, you know, contract to approve or anything like that today. No. We're getting there. Sorry, stealing your thunder a little bit, but when we do come to you with contracts, you know, this is indicative of the things that we are able to accomplish, and we appreciate your support in ensuring that we have the tools to be successful.
Thanks. So the point I really do want everybody to take away today is project work in sustainability is a lot more than just building more solar. right? That's kind of where the work started. But as we achieve our goals, Xcel achieves their goals of decarbonization, we have to look at ways of delivering that power, using that power more judiciously, and being ready for any change, whether it be weather-related, system-related, population-related, that we might face, so that we can continue to deliver reliable, carbon-free, affordable energy where and when it's needed. We work in four areas on the team. Solar generation and storage is run by Noah Katalfamo. Public and EV charging is Rebecca Colson and Hayden Hogaboom. Resilient city buildings is my colleague Kimber here and Allison. And then I'm there on the bottom, thermal decarbonization. And we think of our work as really taking three shapes. One is we demonstrate the work that needs to be done so that others can eventually follow us. We need to evaluate that work so we can then effectively communicate about the results of our projects. When you are on the leading edge, as the city of Denver is in general on climate work, we are going to be doing things that are new. That is exciting for people like me. It is challenging and scary for some others, but we need to be there to be able to help discover the challenges that are as yet unknown, coach others through the same process that we have been through, and you know, constantly evaluate, are we on the right path? Are there other ways that we can achieve our desired outcomes? You can go back for a second. We've been historically in the demonstrate mode. CASR is a young agency. We stood up quite a few projects very quickly. As our internal processes have matured, our team has grown a little bit, our relationship with Dottie has deepened, we're able to activate other folks around the city so that we can start to move some of our attention towards that evaluation and communication role that we see ourselves. You know, projects really do touch everything that happens around us. It is a bi-directional relationship. Everything that we do in our projects group ideally is informing somebody else and helping them do their job. We are also trying to take our cues from other folks who are engaged either in policy, community engagement, working with other agencies to help us shape our projects so that they could be most impactful. The interagency support on there is something I really like to point out. Our relationships that we can create in the other project management groups over in Department of Finance, everywhere else around the city, is how we're going to find our force multipliers and see this work get bigger. We are a small team. We can only do so much, and we need a lot of others to get on the train, you know, trust us that we know where we're going. You know, we have built a lot of, next slide, thank you. Our project culture is really focused on customer service. We are a group that serves many different clients at any given moment, but we see that doing things right the first time, making sure we have a clear and relatively lofty goal we are trying to accomplish and we stick to it, we don't compromise along the way. Recognizing that for most of our projects, the people that are going to interact with that, it's going to be their only time interacting with the work that CASR does. They may or may not know it, and so we better make a good impression. And then finally, our partner agencies are really the key to our success. Happy hosts make happy projects. We have built that through being reliable and informed and trustworthy, responsive, action-oriented, all of these things that our partners are looking for, so they are not feeling like our projects are becoming their problems, right? And that extends not only during the projects, but well after, throughout the course of the life of the asset. You can see our spread of projects. I'm even gonna note this is only two of our four areas of work. This is solar and storage, and then EV and public charging. We do not have our buildings work on here yet. And you can see we touch every district, every part of the city. We think some uniformity and presence in every community is really important. Kind of prove our mettle that we are investing in all parts of our community. As well as understanding the different challenges that are experienced in different parts of the city. Our efforts in downtown look very different from that kind of first ring outside of downtown, and that looks much more different when we get into southeast, northeast, you know, these communities that were built at a different time. Right.
Thank you.
We've, through our work, we've identified internally that managing electrical demand is like the key to achieving full decarbonization or even getting really close to it. All things cost pale in comparison to rebuilding our electric grid. And so thinking about all the different ways that we are increasing that demand on the grid, as well as ways that we can shift that demand or decrease it, they all add up to avoiding significant costs borne by the utility that then get passed on to ratepayers, right? We are trying to encourage not only public investment, but trying to bring in private investment that can avoid those utility investments that then lead to higher rates. All right, I'm gonna go through each of those four project areas quickly. Feel free to interrupt and ask questions. In our solar generation and battery energy storage work, we have been very successful in those projects. Those were the first we got off the ground, starting with our Renewable Denver Community Solar Program. So far, that program not only serves six commercial customers, but right now we're supporting over 300 Denver families. We're recruiting 250 more families to enroll in the program. We'll add another 250 more before we're done. We have more than 7 megawatts of solar already in operation. We forecast about $13 million in total bill savings provided to all of the various subscribers we have, and the vast lion's share of that going to our low-income subscribers that we partner with through Energy Outreach Colorado and Denver Public Schools. About $12 million of those savings we see going towards that group. We have just moved into working on our what we call behind-the-meter projects, or projects that directly serve city facilities, and that includes the city's first battery energy storage system that we commissioned 2 weeks ago. For us, that's a pretty exciting threshold to pass through. We think that distributed batteries are the way we are going to solve a lot of the demand challenges by decoupling demand from supply. Right now, we need to generate the kilowatt hour that we need right when we need to use it, more or less. When renewables are more time dependent, solar we produce during the day, wind largely gets produced during the night, there becomes a big mismatch. And you might have seen this as the duck curve. It's called a lot of different things. A lot of research has come out of California on this, where they have high saturation. We need to figure out ways that we can store that energy and use it when and where it's needed. So getting our first battery commissioned is huge. We're already seeing better than 50% peak demand reduction in that facility, and that's over at Green Valley Ranch Library. If you want to go take a look at it. And that's all going to lead us to our next areas of work, which is microgrids. That's one step up. Much larger battery can serve many other purposes. So that's going to be some work that's going to prove what these larger capacity batteries can do, and we can use to inform our utilities commission interventions to try and create rate tariffs that encourage that sort of investment from others. And then finally, this all goes to this idea of a virtual power plant. When we have these distributed resources all over the city, ideally the utility can call upon them as needed to dispatch their energy and be used whenever it might be needed, right? So right now we do that through peaker plants by burning extra natural gas, pushing it through the transmission system, and then sending it out through our local distribution. This is a totally different model where the power is being stored in those neighborhoods, in those commercial areas, and so we don't need additional transmission or distribution infrastructure to move that power around.
That's cool. Really cool.
Also a way for like other people to invest and like make money by being a part of the utility network. It's not just one company producing and selling, but it's a lot of different actors that are continuing to either maintain or better yet, drive the price down of each unit of energy that we need to use at any given time. We have some really great quotes here from our community solar program that we gathered from our partners at Energy Outreach Colorado. They are universal. People really appreciate this. If not for the actual dollar amount, like the sentiment that people are there to help them when they need. And it gets them engaged in this clean energy revolution, right? Like, people need to feel like they're a part of it to think that the investments that others are making are worth it on their behalf. And so we think this, and we got one more slide that's similar to this. We think this really proves that point, and love getting this feedback. We do try to keep a little bit of an arm's length because that is a program managed by other folks. We try not to complicate it for them, but we do love when we get this feedback and can share that with you. For our public and fleet EV charging, we really focus around two priorities with one common thread between the two of them. One is widespread, convenient, and reliable public charging. So that means people see chargers all over the place. They know they're going to work when they want to go use them. They can afford the power that is provided to them. And it allows them some ability as individual actors to say, oh, I feel more confident that the charging is going to be there in my neighborhood, even if it's not, I can't put it at my house quite yet, or I'm in a multifamily building that is a much more challenging environment to build EV charging in. And then on the fleet side, fast, reliable, and location focused. So working with our fleet partners to understand where and when are you going to be getting vehicles? Can we get out ahead of you and provide that charging ahead of time? This is all about removing barriers, real or perceived, so that people can make that decision to buy that next EV, to even ask the question, is this something that's right for me? And then the one through line here is reliability, right? Things have to work. That's the starting point for us. And so we have stood up not only an EV charging asset management program, we have a similar one for our solar and battery work, so that we can make sure that the infrastructure we build is going to work. That has to be the given. If anybody is out there thinking, oh, I'm not really sure if this is going to work when I show up, like, we have failed, and we have a lot of repairing to do for that interaction with our constituent. Resilient city buildings. I don't think it's any surprise over the long course of history, investments in operations and maintenance of large buildings has gone down. Other priorities come up. Those things are more time dependent, and those get funded. We understand how that goes. I've been in buildings for a long time. It's not just us, right? This is everybody. But we can do something about our buildings. Through Kimber's work, we've identified almost 80 systems that are well beyond their useful expected life. We have many more, 350 systems that are going to be coming to the end of their useful life in this or the next decade that we need to be planning for. Our work, combined with efforts in partnership with Dottie to take on both low-hanging and high-hanging fruit, invasive, non-invasive, operational changes we can make, are here to prove to others that we can reduce our energy costs, we can increase the reliability of our buildings, and we can improve the health and safety of those systems in our buildings. As things get old, they break, right? And if something breaks and you haven't planned for the replacement, you are stuck with putting the same thing back in there. And so our folks don't have the opportunity to improve their systems even if they wanted to. And so by creative ways of raising the funds for this, none of this is cheap, by creatively raising the funds, thinking about how those investments pay back over time, cost avoidance, we really see this as an opportunity to level up our buildings to both meet Energize Denver ordinance requirements, as well as like improve the actual conditions that not only our community comes and interacts with us in, but our colleagues around the city, our facility managers, the environment in which they work to do the work for the city. And then the last item, renewable thermal, a real passion of mine. Many of you may have heard that we recently completed a report that we call the Denver Downtown Ambient Loop. This is rethinking district energy. District energy for well over 100 years has been the most efficient way to especially heat, but now more recently cool, dense downtown environments. We have the oldest continuously operating steam system. That's very cool. It also comes, you know, all the things come with age, including leaks and failures and costs and all these other things. So we really want to rethink, instead of having two independent heating and cooling systems, can we unify those into a single system that works at a lower temperature, a lower pressure, can balance the input costs from the winter to the summer so that we drive down the input cost overall. Right now, we have to put fuel into the steam system to create the steam all year round when it's needed. We have to put energy into the cooling system to cool buildings all year round when it's needed. But we actually, in a unified environment, we can take heat from one building that is excess, and we can put it into another building that needs it. We can do the same thing with cooling. They are the same in this one, just is forwards, the other one is backwards. I also want to point out kind of four outcomes. One, we have determined out of the 14 buildings that we looked at, those are city-owned facilities, starting at the convention center, working all the way over here, and including the Art Museum and Central Library, that we can electrify those buildings in all, but we expect one case without having to modify the existing electrical service into that building. That is a very expensive part. If we have to upgrade electrical service, those will often make projects unfeasible, at least right now. And we see that in our private partners also who are trying to do this work in their buildings. Thermal resources exist. We have the space and we have the thermal resources to run a system like this without having to burn anything at any time. That's kind of the key point. Through geothermal resources, sewer heat recovery, using the existing chilled water system, we can run a system like this today. We get to reuse most of the existing building infrastructure. We do not need to entirely change the concept of the HVAC systems in these buildings. We just have to change the way the heat gets into them. And then last, overall demand reduction. I've modeled about 11 megawatts of overall demand reduction just for these buildings. We think that turns into 50, 70, 100, you know, many times more if we look at a downtown-wide approach, if this would ever be viable. And we really do want this to be a market-based solution. We want to show that it works, let other people invest in it, and have a profitable business for somebody to run that is still low cost for the consumers. One last thing, Johnny. Just on the bottom left, we also took a 40,000 foot look at, you know, is this the right idea? Just because we're kind of energy nerds and we think this is really not only cool, but also effective. Like, is this the right solution based on other factors? So we did try to look at who is this going to disrupt by taking a certain approach? Where is the cost going to be borne? Is this going to increase or decrease operating costs over time? And through that evaluation, we saw that the ambient loop does still look like it is at the top of the list. There are some pros for other systems out there that I'm happy to discuss, but we still think when you look at everything combined, this sort of unified low temperature system is the future that we can accomplish right now. And then just to close up, you know, we really do think about the big picture. It's not just checking boxes. It's proving that the reality we say is possible really is possible. We also know that this is a long slog, and we cannot do it all tomorrow, but we have to start today to eventually get there. We're investing wisely. We want to, like I said, walk that walk. We want to find compelling community co-benefits. So if we can provide something else alongside our capital project, we're going to do that every single time. Sometimes that's very direct, like providing shade over gigantic hot parking lots. Sometimes it's more indirect by, you know, improving the air quality near a facility that has to, you know, run their boiler a lot in the winter, for example. But we really do think about that, recognize the importance of getting things right. Again, we feel like we're in a no-fail environment. Our projects have to work. They have to work the way we say they're going to work, and it has to be the first time. We want to enable others to act by showing the way, supporting them, telling them about our successes and failures, even though there won't be any of those, as I just said. And, you know, be a partner.
This is recorded, right?
For sure. Be a partner through, you know, everybody's, you know, changes that they're going to have to make to meet our carbon-free environment. It is going to require a change from everybody. The more support we can provide, the better experience people are going to have, and that is going to multiply. Lastly, we know that we have to leverage our partnerships with stakeholders. That's both internal and external. We have to be out there talking about these things, getting good press, because we need scale. If we stop at what we are able to accomplish just out of our little office, it won't be nothing, but it won't be enough. And so we really need to see these things scale and get repeated by others to be able to tell the tale of our success. I'll open for any questions.
Yep. Councilman Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I am absolutely on board with we need to do a rapid and robust transition away from dinosaurs. We keep digging them up and spewing them in the air, and we're seeing some pretty dramatic changes at this point because some people are ignoring that we're intentionally saying that scientists are wrong and this isn't happening. So thank you. I'm the first elected official in Denver's history to use a wheelchair to get around, the first to identify as a member of the disability community. So two things that you said, as you said, this is being recorded. This is all about removing barriers, and this is a no-fail environment. If you could go back to the slide with the EV charging stations, I made the choice of I wanted to be the change I want to see in the world. Two of those, I don't think I could access at all. The one in the top right, I think I could, I want to be the change I see in the world, so I actually purchased a fully electric vehicle. By the way, I got some great EV incentives. So I bought a vehicle on a two-year lease, paid $800 for all 2 years of the lease, not $800 a month, $800. So that made it kind of an economic decision as well as a Gandhi quote decision. It's like Gandhi. I said it. How about that? I came up with that amazing quote all on my own. I will say, just in the last 2 weeks, it was the first time I actually blocked in. This is one of those large level three chargers, so all of those are level two, I think. But
correct.
Two of them were not functioning. It was a bank of four. Two were not functioning, so the only in the middle two were working. I was the only one there, so I came, stopped. That generally can go from 10 to 80% in 20 minutes, 25 minutes, something like that. So parked, started the charger. There were no, access aisles. So once I'm out of the car I have to plug in the charger. So I've already assembled my wheelchair beside the car, so I might as well stay out until coming back. Well, someone else parked there and I had to wait until they finished their charging before I could get back to my car. I could at least stop it from charging me idle fees, which is something else in case you don't have an electric vehicle. If your car is charged and it's no longer drawing power, then the vendor often will charge an idle fee, which is to encourage people to use a limited resource for only as long as they need. So I think that we're, in my estimation, starting to see some fail points. And I don't want for us to, at some point in the future, know who the disability community is, because they're the only ones using internal combustion engines because they can't have access to EV charging stations because we're not thinking about access for everyone. So the reason why I say I can't use two of those three spaces, one, the left photo, there not only is it up a curb, but it also has two structural barriers, bollards, that is designed to protect the infrastructure. But it also prohibits me from getting full access to that space or the charger itself. The lower right, I think also I couldn't access for the same bollards, even though it's not up a curb. Maybe I could go behind it. I don't know exactly what the infrastructure is behind it. And so the top right, I think I could get to, unless another vehicle parked, because that one looks like it's right in the middle of that space. And if there's a car that parked close to it, I don't know if I could access it either. So I point that out as in, we can't all think about everything, and producer, you're welcome to take the slide back down. We can't do it. Thank you. we can think about everything, but what we can, once, you know, we can create awareness. And I think that as we, so the fine folks on City Council did pass a new building code, which requires new spaces to have some requirements. I don't know many. The only city-owned electric vehicle charging station bank that I know that I for sure could access is the one at the City Park Golf Course. So I say that I don't know if I have, you know, this is something that I've kind of chatted with Kazra about for a few years now. I'm not trying to kind of point the finger and say, I think we're continuing to fail. But I think there's an opportunity for us to lift everyone up. And as a government, I hope that we spend the people's money, all the people's money, in a way that works for all the people. And so I'm not trying to say that I'm screaming into the void and I feel like I'm not being heard, because I hear people in CASR saying, we hear you, we just don't know how to fix it. So anyway, just bringing that up, trying to be as gentle yet educational as I possibly can.
We appreciate that. We do, not only as required by code, but as a matter of our policy, like include a universally accessible stall in every one of our CASR installed charging sites. We had to learn how to do that. And working with HRCP, who we share a floor with, really helped us understand what the requirements are, what some strategies are that we could employ. And I think you'll see the charges that we're finishing up towards the end of this year will have better results. You know, some of that is trying, just getting feedback and understanding the real lived experience of folks compared to what ends up in the accessibility board handbook, which is pictures that are only so helpful. And then eventually, you know, being able to go back and repair, update previous locations that either were installed well before us, or, you know, were before we had, you know, figured out how to be successful on that.
Yeah, and I don't know if you included those three photos because you thought they were, you know, something that you want, the prize demonstration of what we could do, or I would encourage the City Park, you know, photo of the EV charging stations at City Park. I would even say that's a bit of a miss as well, and I'll share why. So civil rights is about equal access for the, you know, a protected class. We've come up with, America as a society has come up with several groups of people that we believe are important to, because of past harms, that we want to lift them up today. So, you know, people with disabilities are a protected class. And so the way the City Park electric vehicle charging bank works, there are four chargers. One of them is marked with the international symbol of accessibility, the blue wheelchair logo that says only people who qualify have access to those spaces. So of four, one of them is reserved for people with disabilities. That's 25%. Between 10 and 12% of Colorado drivers qualify for one of those placards or plates. 90% placard, 10% plate, just in case you're interested. And so we are reserving 25% of spaces for 10 to 12% of Colorado drivers. So I would say that's preferential access, not equal access. So the idea of universal design, where all the spaces are a little bit wider, really is, you know, 100% of the people can access 100% of the spaces. So I'm doing this because we're being recorded. That's the camera that's on right now. So really that's that, so that we have this, you know, documented. So that's, I recognize where the direction for City Park Golf Course was going. If we put all the spaces in a way that everyone can access them, let's say there are four spaces, anyone can access any of the spaces, all four are taken. Someone with a disability comes, they should wait. That's what everyone else would do. That's equal access. So so that's my my case for universal access, and that's why I believe City Council voted to adopt the building code that works for all new parking lots. Obviously, we've got a whole bunch of legacy parking lots, not sure exactly what to do about them. But anyway, so a little bit longer, for the record. So thank you.
No, and thank you, and we appreciate that observation and commend Drew's team as well of really documenting our approach, our lessons, our things, so that we can create better standard guidelines for ourselves and for our partners, and then ultimately for the community, so that we can just continue to improve. And your feedback and guidance is really helpful for us in terms of making sure each project is better than the last.
I will mention I probably didn't do myself any favors on cropping the photo to get it into the right size, because just out of frame is actually where the charger is for that universally accessible stall. It's at the end of the hashed access aisle. It's not bollard protected where the handles are. I think we might have put some on the sides. I didn't do the install. So like I said, we've been really mindful of, one, taking the guidance that's available to us, looking at the results of our work and saying we could have done this or that better. And we're seeing that in our work this year.
Yeah, and I'd love to, chat with you more about some of the thoughts that, the federal government has PROAG, the proposed right-of-way accessibility guidelines, which has some guidelines around access to EV charging stations for people with disabilities. Who knows if this administration will move forward with that, or even if we will have a Department of Justice that enforces or considers a protected class like people with disabilities. But I would say even, I think there's some limitations with the federal recommendation. Interestingly, we passed our building code before the state took action. The state has now passed some legislation, and they said, I think it's 2026, the state shall adopt the federal guidelines. And so I think we're kind of going backwards at the state level too. So to your point, I think Denver is leading and has the opportunity to continue to do so. Maybe California's a little bit ahead of us, but the challenge there is I don't think it's statewide. I think it's different municipalities have come up with their own regulation. So, this is really an opportunity for Denver to shine, just as CASR is a beacon, nationwide, as an agency. I think this is an opportunity for us to be a beacon too.
Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Alvidrez.
Thank you so much. This was great. Thank you. I appreciate learning about this. I think something I have heard from community is like, you're making us do all of these things. What is the city doing? And we just recently were working on composting together, which I think that was a big thing. It's like, we're making all of our residents compost, elderly, low income, whoever, and our businesses are not happy that they have to maybe do that. Some are very happy, I will say. And we're not doing that as a city. If you go to Denver Park, we're not composting and recycling there anymore. So I think it is really important with all those things that you said. And also, I think generally we definitely trust the work and the expertise that you all have. I think there's always like little bits of our lived history that is why we were elected, to kind of point out people that may be left out on things. But overall, I'm really proud of this work in particular that we're doing. There are some things that I'd love to understand. I believe one of the projects that is probably part of this work is at Harvard Gulch Rec Center. Where does that power go to? Does it power the rec center? I'm just curious.
Yeah, great question. That's part of our Renewable Denver Community Solar Program, and that was part of the first 10 projects we did. It was started, I don't know, 3-4 years ago at this point already. The Community Solar Program is a Utilities Commission created program that requires investor-owned utilities to provide the service. So typically, you'll build solar, you connect it into an existing set of loads, a building, for example, and the solar will be used by the building first and then backfeed into the grid, whatever's excess. We just take the loads out of the equation there. All this power goes directly into the grid. Without getting too deep into, electricity, yes, it does go to the building that's right next door first. Mm-hmm. It is the shortest pathway. But this is all accounted for on kind of a grid scale, right? And so that gets all the power gets counted up as it gets put into the grid. Our vendor through Energy Outreach Colorado and CSP Community Solar Platform, they then assign all of those credits to our various subscribers. They tell Excel about it, and it shows up on their bill. So it is a little bit of accounting magic.
Sounds very confusing.
The simple version is our wire connects to the grid. Yeah. We count every kilowatt hour. We get an equivalent number of bill credits. A portion of that goes to the rec center to yes. fully cover the rec center's needs. And then excess power is assigned to low-income families that we identify with Denver Public Schools and Energy Outreach Colorado.
That helps, yes, the Denver thanks. Public School, because that was kind of what I was wondering. Who is getting the credits, if there's any left?
Yeah.
So they're identified through the school system?
Yeah, so when we were designing the program, we had that big question of, you know, is this something we work with council members and create, mm-hmm. you know, an application form, but then we're deciding who does or does not get this benefit. The partnership that Energy Outreach Colorado and Denver Public Schools have was one that we wanted to leverage, because they already have an office that families can go to and say, you know, I'm behind on my bills, I'm struggling, you know, I need assistance. And then this becomes a tool in their toolbox. There are other utility programs or state-funded programs and federally funded programs that Energy Outreach Colorado has access to. This becomes yet another resource. So that way we're not sending families to a place where there's, you know, only so much support that we can provide, and then the wait list builds up. We're adding more resources to the folks that are trusted to deliver this benefit to our community members, and they've done a great job, and we're very pleased with that program. So if you all were to reach out to your constituents, mm-hmm. it's more of a, hey, if you need help, Energy Outreach Colorado is the place to go, and they're the ones who aggregate all the various resources that are available to provide those services.
I would love to see some data on that, of how many families are getting help, how many dollars are we talking about with those credits and where those families are. I think that would be great. And then my last question, well, first of all, thank you, Kimber, for your work on like identifying the HVAC work that needs to be done. Is this something that you've been doing for a long time? Is this a new project that you've been working on? Because I think that is amazing, and it will save us. We're in a budget crisis. Like, these are the types of things that we need to be doing. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Councilwoman. We're very excited about this work. It started picking up steam in late September, or in September 23, and we got contracts going so that all through 2024 and beginning of 2025, we had energy service companies do energy audits at all of our municipal buildings. That's about 165 energy audits that were completed in that 1 year. And so we've also come to not only get a plan for compliance with Energize Denver, but a plan for what that building needs. And also use equity indicators and heat map identification, or, you know, high heat areas to prioritize yeah. our work. And so we tried to also show how we were doing that in our bond package. And so this is work we've been doing since late 2023, we've got the audits done. We know what we're going to do now, and we are starting the energy efficiency contracts. Well, they're going to be presented to council in a few months, mm-hmm. a few weeks. And then we are working with our partners in Dottie to get those mechanical replacements in our buildings done. We will have to work at the pace of our funding, and so that's what we've been spending a lot of our time on. Our resources have been somewhat limited with changes to national policy and also resources here in Denver. But we will continue to work and identify that capital stack and work with our partners to get those replacements done.
I appreciate that. I think that's really important work. One thing that I noticed in this building, so I imagine it happens elsewhere, is that not everyone in this building has air conditioning. So some right. of the courts workers are like having several fans. It's like walking to like a time that I thought we had passed. And so I'm curious, looking at the equipment that we need to replace, yes, and what about the people that still don't have air conditioning that are like city workers and things of that nature?
That is the great part of the work we've identified is in these replacements, we're using heat pumps to electrify the equipment, and they have the capacity to do cooling. And so while we're doing this work, we're adding a feature that we did not have before. In our bond package that we submitted, some of the energy usage actually showed up as negative change. And that's because that building was now receiving cooling, but overall the bond package gave energy savings and cost avoidance to the city.
What bond are you talking about?
I'm sorry, the Vibrant and Dipper bond package that we put together.
That's coming.
Yes.
To the ballot in November.
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Yes.
So that's not guaranteed money at all.
Yeah. No, no, and I apologize.
No, it's okay.
The scope of opportunity that we identified obviously exceeds what ultimately is going to be referred to voters, but it's enough to get us started. And then we continue to invest through Climate Protection Fund, whatever other resources are available, and then working with our facility teams where, let's say, you know, we're building a new building or we're doing a renovation project. How do we design it from the start so that we're contemplating these things and planning for the more efficient and pollution-free option, and just increasingly have that become status quo, where it doesn't need to be a standalone bond package with, you know, a line item for, you know, facility electrification. It's just, hey, this facility is due for replacement. We're going to replace it with the thing that we know we need for the future.
So is that part of the facilities line item of the bond?
I think we can follow up with you and point out where
that
we've
would be
seen
helpful,
yeah, stuff that would be dedicated to us to deploy through our, say, kind of direct investment strategy, and then others where we see that there are facility improvements that are being contemplated that we'll seek to influence positively.
Yeah, I think I would love to see the data on, like, where those funds are allocated and what the dollar amount is.
Yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Pro Tem. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question a little bit about the projects across the city. You had talked about, you know, projects across the city. And maybe I missed it in the presentation. What was uploaded to Legistar, there was a map of the projects. And I was just curious, like, in Southeast Denver and District 4, what are those projects? And is it possible, if you don't have them off the top of your head,
the producer can put up the map?
I mean, I could easily separate those and send you some details on them.
No, they're good, man.
Look at this. Those are three of those four are EV charging projects, as indicated by the little automobile. Two of those are future. So if it's not in the little circle, that means it's a future project. If it's in the circle, that means it's completed and in service. And I think the Sun is going to be, is that Thomas Jefferson High School that's over there?
Yeah.
That would be our community solar project we just completed at the high school there. Also has EV charging on site. So most of these other ones are going to either be like a parks and rec facility. The two in the bottom far right are Kennedy Soccer Complex and Kennedy Ball Fields. Or they're going to be a library. We're partnering with Denver Public Libraries to identify locations where they're already doing projects, and we can kind of swoop in and add some EV charging to those locations. And so I'd have to look up precisely what that one on the left is.
Actually, there's two libraries that are going to be undergoing construction in the next year at Hampton. The Hampton branch in U Hills, Ross, U Hills Library is going to have construction. So
we are engaged on
circle.
Ross.
Okay.
And to be timing so that we only disrupt the operation of the library once to time our work with Dottie's over there.
Okay, that's great. And tell me the difference between the red car and the yellow car, or just...
Great question. Red is fleet, yellow is public.
Okay. Out of curiosity, so fleet means only city vehicles can charge there.
Correct.
Okay. Are the fleet vehicles also tied into, as like Denver Parks and Rec is looking to increase their electrical vehicles, is that part of the fleet vehicles that are listed?
Yeah, I have the Huron and Lowry maintenance shops that are shown on here. We meet with Parks once a month specifically to talk about all things electrification, much more often just in the normal course of business. But they identified the locations where they were expecting to receive EVs first, so their forestry location and Lowry. And we've been working with them to identify what sort of charging do they need, just not always a straightforward question. And then how, when, where can we get it built? And so we've already started working on both of those projects, and I expect we'll be in design before the end of the year on those. So we do try to reach out to each of the different agencies. Our other teammates who work more specifically on mobility policy with the fleet managers, they're, again, informing our work to help point us in the right direction.
And then I have another question about just EV chargers in general. How many public EV chargers do we have in the city?
Total or city-owned?
City-owned. I know oftentimes my sister, it's not me, but my sister just got an EV charger, and she had the list of all of these charging stations available, but they weren't all public. Mm-hmm. And some of them were, private or in, closed spaces that she wasn't able to access. How do we discern that? Because I think we talk about, we have a lot of EV chargers. Yeah, okay, then maybe you could talk a little bit more about it. But I think the challenge is we say we have all these EV chargers, but they're not all publicly accessible.
Yeah, that's a big part of our, mm-hmm. That specific group on our team, trying to really help to clarify that information for our constituents. I drive an electric vehicle, you get the PlugShare or the ChargePoint app or whatever, mm-hmm. encounter the same exact problem of, it looks like, wow, we've got hundreds of chargers across the city, but what can I actually access? As of our most recent count, there's 150 public fast charging plugs in the city. That's probably, maybe 2 to 4 plugs per location. So let's say, 75-ish locations out there that you can get a public fast charge. We actually have a better ratio right now of the number of plugs per electric vehicle than we do gas stations, gas pumps per internal combustion engine vehicle. There's just a lot more gas pumps, so it's much more ubiquitous in terms of seeing them. That's the experience that we ultimately need to create for the public to shed away that kind of anxiety and that fear of, I would get an EV, but where can I plug it in? How do I know it's going to be reliable? And getting people out of charging, at the loading dock of their local grocery store in the back under a flickering light bulb, and into this is a convenient place where I can actually sit, read the paper, get a cup of coffee, whatever it might be. That customer experience, like Drew mentioned, it drives us from the projects that we build. It drives us in terms of the experience that we need to create for our community. So we'll be looking at, the pace of electric vehicle adoption and making sure that, for our own fleet adoption trends, we're staying ahead of it in terms of our charging needs. But very importantly for the public, we want to continue to encourage Denverites to be able to adopt electric vehicles and do so with confidence. Colorado actually just surpassed California as the highest percent of new EV registrations, which is really exciting. But we're only going to maintain that leadership if our infrastructure keeps pace. So I'm confident we'll do it, but we have to work on permitting, communication, and access to information in ways that are going to be beneficial for members of the public.
Thanks. Go ahead.
As one of the 150 number that Johnny referenced, those are not city-owned. All the fast chargers are owned by a charging company, Tesla or ChargePoint or something. We are working on a public mapping layer that we can put on our website that shows all of the city-owned public facilities and that we can keep updated to kind of give people a little more access. But then finally, all of our public chargers, except for City Park Golf Course, are ChargePoint brand. And so they're all available on the ChargePoint app, and that has, I think, probably a little more filtering ability to identify publicly accessible charging.
And I think, fortunately, we're seeing more standardization in the industry as well, where, up till this point, there might be 4 different charging heads that would be used by your vehicle and by, charger brand that you're going to, which just, again, creates more confusion of, am I actually going to have the plug that I need at the place that I go to, and will it be working? So things are starting to standardize, and we'll see everyone is now adopting the North American Charging Standard, which was initiated by Tesla. And then that'll be the standard that we'll see in use going forward, with more convenient adapters for legacy model vehicles as the conversion just happens over time.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I do have another question around, you said that we have the highest number of, in Colorado, of EV vehicle registrations, correct? No? Statewide? Is it city or statewide? Percent.
And Denver is ahead of the statewide average, so.
So yeah. Do you have conversations, interjurisdictional conversations with our with our neighboring cities and counties? Because I imagine, you know, Denver, a leader, we have all of our charging stations. What are the other counties doing? Are they also on a plan? Is there conversation for the region?
Yes, and that's really organized and led by the state, where they obtained substantial funding to help build out charging infrastructure corridors. Mm-hmm. So that way it's not like, okay, great, we can charge in and around Denver, but, you know, good luck getting to the mountains or to the western slope. That connectivity is going to be really key to continued adoption. And then the other really important stakeholder in this is Xcel Energy. They have also received substantial approvals and state law, creating funding for them that can help to invest in and build out those networks. So ultimately, like, you need someone to, you know, be the station owner operator, but you need the utility infrastructure to actually bring the power and make sure that things are reliable. So those are going hand in hand. So there's the statewide strategy as well as the localized investment strategies. And last thing I'll say on this, as Drew mentioned, you know, downtown has a different need and use case as the next ring, and, you know, our different building types and configurations are going to warrant different approaches. So we're looking at multifamily housing charging strategies, you know, support for single family homeowners, support for workplace charging, support for that public fast charging experience, and trying to come up with that portfolio of options, testing things and seeing what really works well and what's taking in the market and what creates the best customer experience, and then reinforcing those strategies as we go forward.
Speaking of state leadership, both Rebecca and Hayden on my team participate in the state, I'm going to get the name of the group wrong, but Charge Clean Colorado, I think is what it's called. That's a technical and administrative cohort that gets a lot of idea sharing between different jurisdictions and private actors to ideally increase penetration of chargers.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just have a few questions for you. The first one is, I was curious as to what a virtual power plant was.
Sure. I laugh because I was a very big virtual power plant skeptic for a long time. They seem very complicated and require a lot of individual to make the right decision at the right time. And I actually see a big shift in the model moving forward. But virtual power plants, as the name kind of indicates, just take the place of a traditional power plant.
Okay.
So instead of having a single location where you are consuming a certain type of energy to spin a turbine to make electricity, that is happening kind of all over the place. And through the Internet of Things, we can call upon that dispatchable power, it's often called, whenever it's needed, right? And so everything is connected at this point. Either a private company that operates one of these things or the utility itself can say, hey, we have this demand in this area, discharge if you can. And those folks who are discharging at that time would get paid for the energy they're putting back onto the grid.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's quite literally taking the jobs that would have been in an actual power plant and you're kind of able to work and do the same thing from a remote location?
I would say it's more about the infrastructure than the jobs.
Okay.
Still need the people to be paying attention as to the health of systems. Are they actually working as needed? When do we need to call that dispatch out?
Uh-huh.
I want to try to make some, you know.
No, I appreciate it.
Separation there.
Sorry, Johnny. Yeah. If I could try to, you know, simplify. So on a hot summer day, you know, as everyone gets home from work, turns on their air conditioners and whatnot, that's when we experience our peak on the system. The way that Xcel Energy currently meets that peak is they turn on another power plant, you know, burn more gas. Mm-hmm. This is the alternative to that of, because we have smart systems, we have batteries, we have, you know, people who might be plugging in a car, you can actually send a signal that says, hey, you know, send us energy from your battery. Now we don't need to turn on the power plant.
Wow.
So that's kind of
that's
the idea conceptually, but there are myriad technologies we can use, whether it's, you know, solar power that was put into a battery, stored, and then is deployed for this purpose, just asking our car chargers to wait for an hour uh-huh. before they actually start pulling power from the grid, you know, toggling how quickly your air conditioner is running so that, you know, we actually reduce the amount of demand that's being pulled while trying to retain, you know, comfort for the individual. Paying people for their, you know, participation in these programs of bringing flexibility to the grid. It's kind of it's a very catch-all term for what are the things that we can do other than turn on that additional power plant at this moment.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure. There was a recent, I don't want to call it a test, a demonstration in Southern California, I want to say 3 or 4 weeks ago, between like San Diego Power Authority, LADWP, the big utilities down there, where they were able to run, I'm just kind of remembering off the top of my head, like hundreds of thousands of homes off of sending a signal out to a lot of small batteries around to say discharge power, and they didn't have to import power into those areas for well over an hour. So it was really a demonstration at scale, but it's really promising to seeing this more widespread for our work. We are developing a microgrid at Central Park Rec Center that is going to be a large battery deployment, and with the idea of being able to test that dispatchability when Xcel needs it, can we show that it does what we think it does?
That's perfect to go into my next question. Okay. So thank you for that, because I was curious what kind of coordination you all have with Xcel that are required for the microgrids. Sorry.
We reached out really early on about this project to try and coordinate both the technical aspects of it. We were trying to do some unique interconnection methods over at that. It's just a unique site. So we want to talk about, hey, how can we keep your workers safe when you have linemen out there in certain conditions? We also want to talk about our proposed operating conditions and say, hey, when we're in this mode, what do you want? Mm-hmm. And the conversation didn't go as far as we needed it to at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we will circle back around when we have a, we will soon be filing for the interconnection of that device. Uh-huh. That'll be a more formal time for their engineers to get engaged.
Okay.
And that's when I expect to get more response.
Okay, understood. We'll talk more.
Okay.
So with the EV fleet charging, is there some kind of like master plan that you all have to determine that build out?
Yes and no.
Okay.
We're working on it. I mean, we know how many vehicles are parked at each fleet site kind of everywhere in the city. We know how ready those vehicles are for electrification. If it's, you know, mostly light duty vehicles, very easy to electrify. It's cost parity, if not cost savings versus our internal combustion engine vehicles.
Uh-huh.
Other things like, you know, solid waste, larger vehicles, they're more pilots. Hey, we need to demonstrate that electric trash trucks can, you know, really do a full day's work as we think about how this scales.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly things like public safety, you know, police, fire, things of that nature. We have to make sure that the vehicles can respond to meet the needs of the community in an emergency. And so we're working on pilots with those folks as well. We have a consultant hired to go to every single facility, look at the layout, the existing electrical infrastructure, identify, you know, on a map, here's the parking stalls where we would install the first sets of chargers, here's how we would lay them out, here's the plan in terms of number of vehicles that live at this site, and over time, how do we expand to meet those needs? Do we need to do an electrical service upgrade? If yes, where do we put the transformer? So yes, in process, and it'll help us make sure that we're staying prioritized year over year and just chipping away at the problem.
Okay, thank you. I'd be curious as you all are building that out what the final product ends up looking like for you all. But I can't remember which of you mentioned this, but you mentioned something about fundraising, and I think it was in the context of the optimization for the buildings. Maybe I might be getting this wrong. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, okay.
Fundraising might have been an odd choice.
Building a capital stack.
Okay, understood. Okay, then I don't have any more questions.
Right, so whether that's grants or, you know, we have a clean energy fund in Colorado that can tap not only their funds, but also some larger lending institutions. Can we identify both with you all, as well as with the city attorney, like good strategies for us to do things that don't impact the general fund or really even the climate protection fund so that those funds can be used more steadily over time? Because these are, we are talking about like large one-time investments that we need to pay for.
That thank you for that. It was very helpful because I was like, what about the six uses? It doesn't qualify, but the capital stacks makes a lot more sense. And then you talked about the prediction of the system life. And I was just curious, do you all have a program that you use to determine how long the shelf life is for the HVACs that you all mentioned?
Yes, thank you for the question. It's not a program so much as guidelines from ASHRAE, the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning.
Okay.
And I think I got that right.
But I don't know if you got it wrong.
You just kept going.
Yeah, that's right.
But so ASHRAE publishes guidelines for different kinds of equipment, and you know, our energy service companies that perform the audits also have their kind of expertise that they also put on top of that.
Okay. And then a follow-up. I know you identified the 70, not the almost 80 buildings. The 300, are 300 plus, are those city-owned buildings?
So those are systems.
Systems.
Yeah, we have heating, cooling, and ventilation. Multiple systems in every building.
Great, perfect.
Yeah.
And then my final question is, I understand CASR, and I understand, what was the slide that you all gave us? The CASR and Dottie, but it feels like that there should be some coordination of some sort with community planning and development. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious as to what that, if I assume it exists, but like, what does that look like?
Yeah, it does. On that slide, I was really trying to show just like the work on the buildings that is going to get done. Who is it going to be executed by?
Okay.
Some is going to be executed directly by CASR. Some will be executed by Dottie. But we talk with CPD partners, I mean, at least every week, if not some of us more often, and those are in, you know, both for specific use cases, EV charging in this scenario, for example, how can we figure this out? Or sometimes more general, just how do we increase the number of types of permits that are getting submitted and moved through and approved?
Perfect. Wonderful. Those are all my questions. Did anyone have anything else? Wonderful. Well, we really appreciate you all coming to give us an opportunity here for you all. I'm going to give us this briefing. We have six items on consent. No one has called them off. And with that, we are adjourned at 2:56.